You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Peter.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Actually, the world is in pretty bad shape. We're going to talk about some of that. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Peter Beinart, publisher of the Beinart Notebook on Substack. Also author of a book you and I discussed on this podcast, author of a number of books. Most recently, I think, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. Is that the right title?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
You have just posted a little kind of monologue thing on your site on the Beinart Notebook called The Danger This War Poses to American Jews, meaning the Iran War, of course, saying it's almost guaranteed to supercharge anti-Semitism. So I want to talk about the war and anti-Semitism and related matters. Yeah. But why don't you start off by telling us what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of bad faith bullshit accusations of anti-Semitism. But there's also, which largely focus on calling people anti-Semitic because they think Palestinians deserve be treated equally. But there is also there is a rising genuine anti-Semitism, which I think is not surprising because, you know, we're seeing a rise of, we're seeing a rise of all form kinds of different forms of bigotry as American liberal democracy is failing. And these things do tend to go hand in hand. So it's, you know, Islamophobia and nativism, anti-Black racism and anti-LGBT sentiment. But I think the anti-Semitism that we are seeing has particular characteristics to it. And one of the characteristics, which is an old story of anti-Semitism, is the idea of Jews as a kind of two things. Jews as a kind of conspiracy of power, basically to manipulate, in this case, Americans. And the second is Jews as not loyal to the United States, but loyal. I mean, it used to be loyal to some global Jewish conspiracy, but now it tends to be being loyal to Israel. And this war where Israel clearly played a very, very large role in getting the U.S. into. I don't think Israel played the sole role. I think there are other explanations, too. But you can't take Israel out of the story. You can't take Netanyahu out of the story. I think he actually plays right into those things, right? I mean, first, basically Jewish organizations pushing for a war that Israel wants, because all the American Jewish organizations, establishment Jewish organizations, I think disastrously are supporting this and have supported a war with Iran for a long time, many of them. And secondly, the idea that there is this kind of shadowy conspiracy, which is basically manipulating, it's funny, if you listen to people like Tucker Carlson, they won't say this part explicitly because they have to maneuver around Trump. But if you read between the lines, it's like Trump is too stupid to understand that this is a really bad idea, but he's being manipulated by Netanyahu, i.e. the crafty Jews. And so I think both of this war, beyond being terrible in its own right for so many reasons, I actually think is going to make the Nick Fuentes, Candace Owens of the world much more powerful. And I think it's going to make it more likely that the next iteration of MAGA is openly anti-Semitic.
Okay. So are all the major Jewish organizations? I mean, J Street is not presumably.
Not J Street. So I the term that I use would be the American Jewish establishment. Mm-hmm. So J Street does have some real influence in Washington now, but if you wanted to get an institutional basis, there's something called the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, most of which are very major.
But Mike Kinsley used to call the president of that organization the King of Kings.
Yes. It's funny because most of the organizations no one ever heard of, but J Street wasn't allowed into that organization. So I'm really talking about AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Committee, the Conference of Presidents. These are the kind of network of what I would call the American Jewish establishment. J Street is anti-establishment, not radical, but anti-establishment.
Yeah, and in fact has been excluded from
in this umbrella organization.
Formally. Okay. So
yes,
I didn't know all the other ones
were turned down.
Had come out in favor, but I guess it's not that shocking. So yeah, okay. So this does feed a trope. I mean, and there's been a trope that's kind of more specific than I think you mentioned, which is that Jews drag us into war, right? I mean that specifically has a has a history in anti-Semitic circles.
Right. And then don't fight in those wars. I mean, even Pat Buchanan, you know, who in some ways hovers over so much of this, right? One of Pat Buchanan's famous lines was, I don't know if we're old enough to remember this, but it was about the Gulf War, right? He said something along the lines, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, he said, the only people supporting this war is Israel and its amen corner in the United States. And then he said, this war will be fought by people with names like, and I think he said something like O'Brien Gonzalez and Leroy Jones or something like that, right? You know,
you're telling me Leroy Jones is not a Jewish name?
Yes, yes. So I think this is also, right, part of this stew.
I mean, it's funny. I remember that just briefly. Yes. That started with, I don't know if you remember, Abe Rosenthal wrote a column in the New York Times saying, I'm going to come out and say it out loud. Pat Buchanan is anti-Semitic. I will say that the juxtaposition of quotes, I wrote, because I was writing about this in the Republic, I looked it up. Yes. And actually, they did put together things Buchanan had said in different places and times. Yeah. It didn't sound as bad in real life. That said, he did later say something, you probably remember this, kind of weird about Brandeis that, I don't know if you remember the quote, anyway, all that aside, there is this history, and it is more pronounced on the anti-war right than on the anti-war left, I'd say. You mention in this, in your monologue, that you worry about it kind of spreading. One complication with what you're saying, I think, is that I gather it's the case that to say what you said has historically been deemed by some to be anti-Semitic. Do you know what I mean? Or should I elaborate?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the argument that I imagine people were saying is, are you accusing the Jews of being responsible for anti-Semitism? I mean, I've heard this for decades. People say that's like saying that the woman, you know, was responsible for being raped because she wore a short skirt, or, you know, this kind of thing. I try to be careful. I don't think that I'm not saying that AIPAC is responsible for anti-Semitism or Netanyahu. The people responsible are the anti-Semites. But if you are Jewish, you should try to find ways to fight against anti-Semitism in effective ways. And if you do things that actually make it much easier for the anti-Semites, you're doing a really, really bad job of being an American Jewish leader. And I think that was the point I was trying to make in my monologue.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the other thing you hear in defending the claim that what you did is anti-Semitic, and if anybody didn't get infer this from the title of your book, you are, of course, Jewish. And I think even maybe Orthodox, I'm not sure, but is that true?
I go to an Orthodox synagogue. What that term means, but I keep Shabbat and pray every day and just keep kosher.
Do you need a Shabbat goy? Is that the term?
I don't particularly, but I appreciate the offer.
Because I'm willing to turn on your lights every Saturday.
Especially given that we don't even live in the same city. That is a really remarkable gesture.
Sacrifice is too great.
Tremendous kind of Christian generosity.
what you hear is it's a variant on what you said, that it's anti-Semitic to say that Israel could do anything that would fuel anti-Semitism. And the elaboration on that you hear is to say that is to conflate Israel with Jews, or Zionism with Judaism, or something. And of course, it's actually not. It is just to say that people who are anti-Semites, or maybe are in danger of becoming anti-Semites, might themselves make that conflation casually and blame Jews for the policies of Israel. And of course, as people pointed out, there are very pro-Israel voices who themselves kind of try to blur the lines between the two, Bibi Netanyahu. But
yes, I think this is right. I think you're getting at what I think is really the root of the problem. I mean, We had this thing during COVID where people were taking out their anger at the Chinese government on people they thought were Chinese, right? And there's a lot of discrimination and some really, really terrible incidents, right? But you didn't have Chinese American organizations basically saying that to be a Chinese American naturally means that you were supportive of the Chinese government, mm-hmm. right? The problem I think we have in fighting against anti-Semitism in the United States is you have these American Jewish establishment organizations essentially saying that to be Jewish inherently is to support the state of Israel, which I think actually then really, you know, you and I are trying to keep these things separate, right? I mean, a Jewish person can support Israel. Fine. A Christian person supports Israel. A Buddhist person can support Israel. But conceptually, we have to understand that they're not the same thing. But actually, the people who are trying to conflate them are, on the one hand, Nick Fuentes is conflating them, right? As both, but on the other hand, the American Jewish organizations are also conflating them, which is part of, I think, why we're in such a difficult situation.
And then meanwhile, they are doing the aforementioned policing, the speech policing, some of them, and is it too cynical to suggest that this whole idea that to say Israel could somehow contribute to anti-Semitism is part of the speech policing that discourages certain kinds of criticism of Israel, period? Because this is a pretty damning, you know, this is something that Israel would have to take seriously. If it's true that they are endangering Jews around the world, although it's becoming more common to say that. I don't know if you caught that. Tom Friedman said something like this in a column a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
But it is. No, am I right to think that this is kind of part of pro-Israel speech policing to discourage this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's certainly the case that I think that the organizations that support Israel would are very, very hostile to the idea that that you could ever say that anything Israel does contributes to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And again, I think one has to be careful not to absolve the actual anti-Semites of the blame, right? No matter what Israel does, there's no good reason to be anti-Semitic, right? It's a form of bigotry. But I think it's also the case that we sometimes end up asking people who don't like Israel to make a distinction between Israel and Jews, which they absolutely should do, that mm-hmm. the people who like Israel themselves don't do. And mm-hmm. I actually think that is a really, really, that makes the fight against anti-Semitism much harder.
Yeah, there was the famous case, I'm sure you remember, where Bibi Netanyahu, who has on one or two occasions actually, mm-hmm. I think explicitly said he speaks for the world's Jews, by virtue of being the leader of Israel. I don't think he said it recently, but he was in France. I guess this was after the Charlie Hebdo thing. He was speaking to a group of French Jews, and he started saying things suggesting, it seemed, that almost their primary loyalty should be to Israel or something, or they should have some fundamental loyalty. And in response, they started singing the French national anthem as a way of taking issue with him. I don't know if you remember that, but...
I don't remember the specific incident, but I think you were pointing... This gets to... There's a real tension here. I mean, it's not just that Israel is an independent, sovereign country that is always going to have its own idea of what's good for Israel, which is not... Mm-hmm. American and French Jews don't vote for the government in Israel, right? So Israel is not... Politically, they are not represented by the state. And so the state often does things that are inimical to diaspora Jews. I mean, some of their best friends are European and American anti-Semites, right, who are super pro-Israel. And Israel's been fine with that, going back to Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. So that's part of the problem. But the other problem is that Israel, the core of the Zionist idea has always been that Jews can't be safe and can't be fully realized, actualized outside of a Jewish state. And so in a weird way, Israel's natural incentive or argument is always going to be say, you should come to Israel, right? So when bad things happen to diaspora Jews, I'm not saying Israel is out and out going and trying to make things bad for diaspora Jews, although inadvertently they do sometimes. But in a weird way, it actually then becomes part of the Zionist narrative. It's like, oh, it's not safe for you? Well, of course it's not safe for you. That was the whole Zionist rationale to begin with. You should go to Israel.
Right. And it's kind of ironic because, I mean, when I think about anti-Semitism today, it usually, at least rhetorically, and maybe this is just superficial and much of it would be there anyway, but it rhetorically is connected to Israel. I think you made this point in the video or maybe you just made it, I don't know, it used to be that there was this vague global conspiracy, according to anti-Semites.
Right.
But now the reference is just to Israel.
Yeah, although you saw, interesting with Epstein, a kind of a fusing of those things in some ways. Because Epstein is kind of, on the one hand, a lot of people saying he's a Mossad agent. On the other hand, a lot of people are saying, well, he's part of some kind of global conspiracy. Now, it's not only a Jew. I mean, there were plenty of non-Jews who are part of that global awful cabal too. But, you know, a lot of people have mentioned that it was, you know, there were a lot of Jews in that too. So I think Epstein in a way is an amalgam of these two things, you know?
Mm, interesting. Has that had a big impact?
My sense is it has. I mean, I limit the amount of time that I spend listening to some of this stuff because it, you know, it's disturbing and dark. But, you know, if you look at Tucker Carlson, for instance, he spent a lot of time on the Epstein stuff. And, you know, it plays all right into his conspiratorial view about everything. And there's a lot of this Epstein Mossad stuff. And that'd be fair. I have no fucking idea about any of this. I don't know who Epstein was. I have no idea. What I do know is that there's the Epstein Mossad thing seems to have really taken off in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. So why don't we talk about the manifestations of rising anti-Semitism you see? And I eventually would like to get into a little bit of a kind of a fine-grained analysis of the whole landscape. Like, there's a difference between a Nick Fuentes and a Tucker Carlson. I don't know if you put them both on the side of anti-Semitism or draw the relevant line between them or what. But before we get into all that, why don't you just say, what are you talking about, like violent attacks or rhetoric online or both? Is it like quantified or what?
I'm thinking about attitudes, really, you know, and I think that, you know, there's obviously the debates about anti-Semitism have been hugely contested. But basically, you know, what I think about it is what I'm thinking about are people who are saying that there's something essentially problematic about Jews and or Jewishness, you know? So when Nick Fuentes is talking, he doesn't just say, you know, Israel's getting us into wars, Israel is, you know, blah, blah, blah. It shows that the Jews don't share our Western values, you know, mm-hmm. The Jews don't share our Christian values, these kind of things. That's where I think, and you know, that's what I think it becomes anti-Semitic. There's kind of some essentializing of Jewishness that is somehow hostile or should be seen as hostile by Americans, by Christians, by Westerners. And that was what I think is rising. I think, you know, Fuentes, I would say, is kind of like, you know, generationally, like I think an ancestor of David Duke, who is also anti-Israel, actually. I think Carlson is really the intellectual descendant of Pat Buchanan. And just as we were saying at the beginning, where Buchanan was kind of walking a little bit of a line, and you had to kind of sometimes squint a little bit, and it depended on how you were going to see things. And sometimes it's a little tricky with Carlson because he's so conspiratorial about everything, you know, that I think it's the way he talks about Israel is partly just, to me, part of this deranged conspiratorial thing. But like, let me just give you an example of something that he does all the time, two things he does all the time that make me uncomfortable. The first thing is he doesn't focus on Israeli, he rarely focuses on conceptually on Israeli oppression of Palestinians. And that's partly because he's an Islamophobe, right? He always focuses on Israel is doing this to Christians, right? And first of all, it drives me fucking bananas, because what's like the Palestinian Muslims don't deserve to be treated equally. But when you do that, you are playing into a very different kind of discourse, right? Mm-hmm. Than when you're talking, which is much more prone to anti-Semitism than talking about Israel and Palestinians, which are the relevant categories. The second thing he does, again, it's just, this is the fever swamp. So Israel has a law of return, right? So it means that any Jew can basically go to Israel and become a citizen day one. And there are people who do that to flee the law, right? I mean, this has happened for a long time. But if you listen to Carlson, if you watch his interview with Mike Huckabee, which is, you know, its own kind of spectacle. There's this huge focus on pedophiles, right? On Jewish pedophiles who can flee to Israel and they're not get extradited to the United States. Now, is that anti-Semitic? I have to say, the decision to focus on I think there's a lot to be critical of the law of return. I mean, I think it's part of Israel's fundamental ethno-nationalist supremacist character. Mm-hmm. But like, why are you focusing all of your attention on this question of Jewish pedophiles? It seems to me there's a way in which you're poking at things, right, that are very dark. And I think that I don't give Tucker Carlson the benefit of the doubt on this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there is an almost separate obsession with pedophilia. I mean,
yeah,
not that any of us approve of it, especially the clinical kind. I mean, the word has kind of two meanings, but I don't approve of any of them. But there is separate from that. Like I heard his interview with Daryl Cooper. It wasn't really particularly about Jews at all. But Daryl Cooper went on and on.
Right.
About, I think, how Podesta, one of the Podesta
Jews,
some
piece of art he had.
Yeah.
I know. This is where it's hard because these people are so conspiratorial. They're not just conspiratorial about Jews. They're conspiratorial about everybody, right? Mm-hmm. But when they talk about conspiracy having to Jews, then they're playing into this very rich stew of a long history of Jewish conspiracy things. So I think there's a lot of gray. I think there's a gray area there. I think what one can say, what I do feel very confident in saying is these are not people who are being sober and careful in the way they play around with what is highly combustible material. And, mm-hmm. and that really worries me.
Yeah. No, I'm also always uncomfortable, when I listen to Carlson, and, you know, I'm ambivalent because as far as the foreign policy of it, in terms of the wars he's opposed to, I'm usually on his side. I like the idea of encouraging opposition to them.
Yes.
And I recognize even that some of these lines work particularly well in his circles and getting people's attention about the wars. That said, I am always uncomfortable about the tribal Christian stuff. And it's not has nothing to do with Christianity or any other thing. It's just that I think tribalism is the problem in the world, you know? And it just shouldn't be that we judge Israel's policy or anyone else's by the effects on Christians per se. You know, I don't know.
And I would just add, I mean, I think that part of the problem is that I think the mainstream media has left this space for Carlson because the mainstream media all the way through Gaza doesn't give Palestinians a platform, doesn't really, you know, is far too credulous when it comes to a lot of things that Israel does and says. And so I think it's part of what's given Carlson his lane. And, you know, he has had some Palestinians on his show who've spoken in much greater length than you find on the mainstream media about what it's like to be Palestinian. And that's really good. Mm-hmm. It's just that I so wish it were not overlaid with some of this other stuff.
Well, were they Palestinian Christians?
They were all Palestinian Christians. Yeah. And it's interesting because his guests, to their credit, don't speak in this. They're actually just talking about human rights. But Carlson is always pushing it into this Christian lane.
And look, to explain to Americans that there's such a thing as a Palestinian Christian is kind of doing a service to begin with, right?
I agree. Because they're so dehumanized as kind of Muslim terrorists, right?
Right. Well, this leads to something that, you talked about the media being lax. Of course, another famous trope is, Jews control the messaging in the media so on. And so what about all that? I mean, well, I'll tell you this anecdote later, but what is your take on that? First of all, what, to the extent that you think the American media has been lax or biased in covering Israel, do you think is the source of that? And do you think, on Tucker Carlson's part, it's an entire misconception to think that some of the bias is, systematic or conscious, or maybe systematic but not conscious, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that goes into this. I mean, first of all, Palestinians are so dehumanized, partly because they're, Arabs and mostly Muslims, and we're still downstream of all of this stuff from 9/11, which just, I think, has produced, Islamophobia that dehumanization is very deep. And particularly, Edward Said, famously said that to be a Palestinian in the West is to be an outlaw. And I think that still remains. So that's part of the issue. And Palestinians are not, and their supporters have not been well organized in positions of power, you know? So that's, I think, the one side of it. Secondly, you know, you have a Christian, you have a Christian Zionist ethos, or just a Christian American tendency to see Israel as part of the West and therefore identifiable. You can empathize with those people. They look, you know, they seem like they're more like us, kind of thing. So I think that's part of it. Then you have, you know, American Jews are disproportionately represented in you know, in the media, elite media. And I think these are just, that's, you know, not, in the same ways, they're probably disproportionately represented in a bunch of different kind of industries, because for various reasons one could go into sociologically, American Jews tend to be, you know, more highly educated and more likely to be in elite professions, at least in this moment in history, you know. And so that's, now again, I think where one has to be careful is that obviously not all those Jews agree, and they're certainly not all working together. I mean, most of the harshest criticism you find in the elite media of Israel is also by Jews. And that's mostly because Palestinians can't get a voice in, right? And so it's often the left-wing Jews who are actually the ones who are, so it's not a monolith or a cabal in any way, but I do think it means that the perspective that American Jews have on Israel is much more front and center than the perspective that Palestinians have. And then I think to add to that is the question of basically, you know, oligarchs, right? And we are in an age, we're in this age of oligarchy, and there are all kinds of different oligarchs. And some of those are Jewish pro-Israel oligarchs, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to say pro-Israel, because George Soros is a Jew with a lot of money, right? But he's not doing this. He's actually doing the opposite. So it's important. It's not their Jewishness, right? It's their pro-Israelness, right? So when you see that David Ellis, you know, Larry Ellison and his son basically taking over more and more media properties, putting in Barry Weiss. And this clearly is a story of part of the story of oligarchy here, in which these particular oligarchs are not only interested in getting rich and blah, 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 they're interested in supportive coverage of Israel. And so they do that. And I think it's absolutely legitimate to call it out. It's just important to say that it's this one particular person. The problem becomes when you say Jewish billionaires as a group, as if they're all the same and as if they're meeting in, you know, in Miami Beach every Wednesday to plot.
Mm-hmm. So let me actually trot out the anecdote I said. I wrote about this in this week's Non-Zero newsletter, actually. Mm-hmm. A piece called Iran and the Immorality of OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google. So about 8 years ago, I wrote a piece for The Intercept called How the New York Times is Making War with Iran More Likely. And it was a dissection of one piece, but it drew attention to, I think, a very common tendency in American media, which is to view things from the perspective of our allies and not the adversaries of our allies. So I said, you know, it was all about how these Iranian, quote, proxies in Syria are there to menace Israel. Israel is terrified and blah, blah, blah. And there was zero mention of the possibility that to some extent, at least from Iran's point of view, groups like this and groups like Hezbollah and groups like Hamas are deterrents to attack by Israel. Right. And by America. I mean, this is the most common asymmetrical perception that starts wars in the whole world. World War One. Even things that may have some degree of defensive motivation as offensive. And so I thought I documented it pretty. Oh, and I pointed out, like, well, who are the analysts this Times piece is relying on? They're from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which, as you know, are they pro-Israel and specifically anti-Iran, I would say. Yeah. And you know, Sheldon Adelson contributed and so on, you know, and there's no doubt about it. And but they have a very big footprint in mainstream media.
Yes.
And I will say
far too big.
And so I did all that. And then I got attacked pretty seriously by Jonathan Greenblatt, president of the Anti-Defamation League, who called the piece, illogical at best and, quote, biased at worst. Now, when the head of the ADL uses the word biased, like, he didn't say anti-Semitic, but that's clearly a shot across the bow, right?
Yeah.
Clearly, it wasn't the first warning shot I got from people like this, but Right. And, you know, I had not mentioned an ethnic group in the whole fucking piece.
Right.
It wasn't
right.
about right. Jews. And it right. wasn't about. And yet, right. the I thought the Anti-Defamation was yeah. about the Anti-Defamation League was about defending ethnic groups, which leads to. I mean, I assume you agree yes. that one of the big functions of the ADL is to has been to police speech about Israel.
Yes, absolutely.
And I guess I'm one question I have is, does that not contribute to anti-Semitism?
Yes, I think it does. Again, I have to say, it doesn't mean it's okay to be anti-Semitic, but I do think, and I think these experiences that people have of being intimidated and bullied produce rage, you mm-hmm. know, and that rage is often not necessarily always publicly expressed because people are, you know, because you are somewhat intimidated. People are somewhat intimidated, but I think it does produce rage, and I think that this is part of the reason that I myself have so much anger at people like Jonathan Greenblatt, who I think have taken anti-Semitism, which is a very real and powerful force in Western civilization and history. And because they can't make good arguments to defend Israel, first of all, they don't know enough. I mean, this is the thing, like these people are not Israel experts. They're really not, right? And in a way, what they do in order to evade having to have a substantive discourse about Israel is they always turn the conversation from a conversation about Israel, what Israel's doing, to a conversation about anti-Semitism, about bigotry, right? That's their mm-hmm. wheels. And then they're basically smearing people in ways that have, they're trading on the power of the idea that you don't want to be an anti-Semite because mm-hmm. some of the worst things in human history have been done by anti-Semites. And they're using that as in, because that's basically the way they can get people, they can try to silence people because they can't actually justify what Israel is doing. And I think it produces, it desecrates actually, I think, the history of what Jews have actually suffered through in anti-Semitism. And it also potentially makes some people so enraged that they basically think all accusations of anti-Semitism are bullshit. I don't think this is what you think, but I think that we are in danger of basically some people being pushed in that direction. And that's why I think it's so dangerous. A wise and sane American Jewish leadership would treat accusations of anti-Semitism with great care as a kind of precious sacred legacy that you tremble before you deploy that accusation because you know how powerful it is and because you don't want to waste it and abuse it and have it lose its currency. But that is part of what's happened. And what's happening is ironically happening as real anti-Semitism actually is rising.
Yeah. And discussion of the phenomenon you just described is also becoming more widespread. In other words, it used to be like nobody wanted to have mainstream respectability would suggest that the ADL is about speech policing for Israel.
Yes.
The other day I saw a tweet by Tommy Veeder, who is like this. He worked in the Obama administration. Yeah. He does this very mainstream podcast. Whenever he talks about Iran, he starts with the necessary, you know, disclaimer that Khomeini is the most evil person ever. Yeah. He's like totally establishment progressive.
Yeah.
And he did this tweet about Jonathan Greenblatt. When the New York Times ran that piece basically saying Bibi Netanyahu worked hard to get us into this war,
he
triumphantly held that up and said, basically, fuck you, Jonathan Greenblatt, and like name checked him. And that is new.
Yes.
That is new.
I think because there is a sense that the public discourse is shifting, right? That those gatekeepers, they still have power. They have a lot of power, but they don't have as much power as they used to. And in a way, like, you know, the more people who say those things and can still still have their jobs the next day, the more people feel like they can. You're seeing the politicians, where politicians are saying, I'm not going to take AIPAC money. This is relatively new, right? And so we're reaching potentially even a potential tipping point. And I think that is great in a lot of ways. It really is. But unfortunately, I also think in some ways it makes it harder then to actually, when we do need to say that something mm-hmm. actually is problematic, particularly because there's another phenomenon. This is the more on the right than on the left. There's this phenomenon in the Trump era on the right in which anytime someone says you can't say something, right, you have to scream it at the top of your lungs, right?
Mm-hmm.
About LGBT people, about Black people, about women, all this stuff. And so the Nick Fuentes thing is part of that. It's part of this transgressive thing too, partly just some ways, just for the sake of being part of transgressive. And I think that's a dangerous thing, which is playing into this.
No, he's getting real traction.
Yeah.
So as you know, Peter, with this podcast, like so many, we eventually reach a paywall. And so we call overtime the section in which we continue to talk that, but in the presence of paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. You've been kind enough to say you'll stick around for a little while.
I know. Now I'm going to have to say things that are really spicy.
Yeah, you laugh, but this is where I say all the stuff that is even more likely to get me canceled than the other stuff. But before we go, I just want to remind people, Biner's Notebook, the Biner Notebook is the name of the Substack, right? And
yes.
The book is being Jewish after the destruction of Gaza.
Exactly, that's it.
And so I want to continue to talk in overtime about the changing conversation and the role, in a way, a lot of it started with Gaza. Shift. But I want to talk a little more about Nick Fuentes and all that and various things. But thanks everybody who stuck around this far. I hope you'll follow us into overtime. And I guess they should rate and review both of our Substacks and
please,
podcasts.
Please,
you know, they should definitely check out your thing. You do a lot of video, a lot of live video, as well as your written pieces. Okay. Yeah. So we're going into overtime.